the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk. Let's read together, shall we, from the book of Isaiah. It's Isaiah chapter 2. We've just begun a series last week on the book of Isaiah called I See a Coming Glory. And this is the second installment of it. We'll recap a little bit in a moment, but let's just read the words of chapter 2 together. Here we go. This is what Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths." The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, house of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. You have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob. They are full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and clasp hands with pagans. Their land is full of silver and gold. There's no end to their treasures. Their land is full of horses. There's no end to the chariots. Their land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. So people will be brought low and everyone humbled. Do not forgive them. Go into the rocks. Hide in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The eyes of the arrogant will be humbled and human pride brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. For all the cedars of Lebanon, tall and lofty, and all the oaks of Bashan, for all the towering mountains and all the high hills, for every lofty tower and every fortified wall, for every trading ship and every stately vessel, the arrogance of all people will be brought low and human pride humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, and the idols will totally disappear. People will flee to caves in the rocks and to holes in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth. In that day, people will throw away to the moles and bats their idols of silver and idols of gold which they made to worship. They will flee to caverns in the rocks and to the overhanging crags from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to shake the earth. Stop trusting in human beings who have but a breath in their nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? So that's the passage we're going to look at. You remember that last week Derek started talking about chapter 1, and he began by quoting Ray Ortland, who writes the notes for the ESV Study Bible on Isaiah. And Ortland says this: Isaiah's call from God was to present a God-centered way of seeing and living that offers everyone the true alternative to the false appearances of the world. Isaiah, in other words, was a man who saw differently from other people in his age. He had a wild, crazy idea that reality was different from what everybody around him thought. He was marching to the beat of a different drummer. He had an experience of God, and we'll read about that when we get on to chapter 6, which had absolutely revolutionized his view of his people and himself and life and where it was all going. And so Derek found three things for us in chapter 1. The first one was, look at our God. That's the first message that Isaiah's got to give. Look at what God is really like. Don't be content with stale ideas, with second-hand comparisons. Look full in the face of what the Bible claims about God and realize who it is you're tangling with. And then the second thing was, look at God's world. Once you've seen God, look at the world around. Look at what God is doing there. Look at the failures of his people. Look at what we ought to be that we're not, and understand what God is doing down through history. And then the third thing in chapter 1 was, look at God's future, because there's going to be a day of judgment. But on beyond that, there's a fantastic new future for the earth. And that's what we've just read, spelled out at the start of chapter 2. What God is going to do is going to be absolutely incredible. Okay, before we get into chapter 2, it might be good to backtrack just a moment and have a look at Isaiah. What do we know about Isaiah himself? And the answer is not very much, but you pick up hints. Isaiah was obviously somebody, for a start, who lived in Jerusalem. Jerusalem comes up again and again throughout his book, and he's clearly in love with the place. It's his city. Mount Zion, the centre, the highest point in Jerusalem, comes up again and again. And Jerusalem, to Isaiah, is very, very important. He's a city dweller. There was another prophet around in Isaiah's day called Micah, and he was a herdsman. He lived out in the country. They clearly knew about one another and worked together in some ways, because some of the words you find in chapter 2, you also find in Micah chapter 4. We don't know who copied from who, but clearly both of them approved of one another and the messages they had. But whereas Micah was the herdsman, the countryman, the simple, plain, straightforward dealer, Isaiah moved in the corridors of power in Jerusalem. And he had a greater grasp than Micah did of what God was doing universally, globally. And so Micah's the prophet of down-to-earth common sense. Isaiah, living at the same time, is the aristocrat, the one who lives in Jerusalem, who understands about politics and diplomacy and world empires, and sees what God is doing in a very confusing world, as we'll see in a moment. He may have been a member of the royal family. There are certainly traditions to that effect. We'll see in chapter 7 when we get there that Isaiah was somebody who had pretty free access to the king. And you find later on with another king, Hezekiah, later on in further chapters, Isaiah can walk in and out of his court and act as his advisor. So clearly he's somebody who's used to being in the important places in Israel, and he understands politics a little bit. He's also a husband and a father. You find that he's married to someone called the prophetess, which may mean that both husband and wife were in the same business, or it might just mean that she was called the prophetess because she was the wife of a prophet. We really don't know. We don't know much about her, but we know that they had sons, and Isaiah was a family man. The other thing that we know about him, I guess, is that he was a pretty educated man. He was aware of what was going on in the world, and he was aware of the traditions of his people. Hugh Williamson, who's the Regius Professor of Hebrew in Oxford University, says this: from the way he writes, we can see that he was well educated in the best traditions of the time. It's not just his fine use of language which impresses, but also the way that he incorporates insights from the distilled wisdom of the Israelite people. You find quotations and echoes and references again and again woven into his work, and clearly he'd studied and understood all of this stuff. So Williamson says, it's probable that such material will have formed an important part of the national curriculum of the time. Only a few families whose children were destined to follow their fathers into the court bureaucracy or other positions of responsibility will have received a formal education, including learning to read and write. It looks very much, says Williamson, and he's perhaps the world's leading Isaiah authority at the moment, as though Isaiah should be included among them. So somebody who was born into privilege, who was well educated, who moved in the corridors of power, and who understood through that conclusive experience he had in chapter 6 what God was doing in a very difficult time politically. It was difficult. Israel was surrounded by all sorts of nations that were hostile. There was Aram in the north, or Moab and Ammon out to the east. Down to the south there's the land of Edom, and they're all pretty hostile to the Israelites. There's Philistia out to the west coast, traditional enemies of the Israelites. There's Tyre up to the north as well. Israel's ringed round by nations that are pretty much the same as she is, who have different gods and different national styles, but who all want to see Israel go down the tubes. And it's not as if Israel is one country any longer either. It's been divided into two. And Isaiah lives in the small bit down in the south, the land of Judah. And he has to keep an eye open for what's going on in Israel all the time, because Israel, at the start of Isaiah anyway, is an enemy of Judah and is plotting alliances against Judah. And we'll see how that leads to a crisis in chapter 7 and beyond. It wasn't just those small nations around either, though. There are big empires in the world right now. To the south, there's always been the massive empire of Egypt, which wanted to swallow all of those small nations up. And now rising in Isaiah's time, there's the Assyrian Empire over in the east. And you'll see just how, from the green bit on the map, just how big the Assyrian Empire was destined to become. And all of those small nations were nervous that one of these days they'd be swallowed up by the Assyrians, which is pretty much what happened. So it's a tricky, troublesome, political time. When was it ever anything else in the Middle East? And if you are a prophet who understands politics in a small nation like that, then you have a very complicated message to deliver indeed. Well, here's a map of the history of the whole thing. We won't go into this in any detail, but that's the way the Assyrian Empire started. There's something not, you know, it's up there, that's fine. Here are the kings of Israel. King Uzziah was probably on the throne when Isaiah wrote these words we've read this morning. He was certainly on the throne when Isaiah had his big vision in chapter 6. But he, towards the end of his life, was stricken with leprosy, and so his son Jotham took to the throne before Uzziah was even dead. Jotham didn't last all that long, though, and even before Uzziah died, his grandson Ahaz was on the throne. And we'll meet Ahaz in chapter 7, because he's the first king that Isaiah had a lot to do with. And the north, in the days of Jotham, started to attack the south, and so the political situation got even worse. Heavy defeats in the days of Ahaz, we'll talk about those when we come, an alliance with the Assyrians, which is absolutely crazy, because it's just opening the door and inviting them to attack you. And then the next king is King Hezekiah, and he was more of a friend of Isaiah's. Now, in the time of Hezekiah, something big happened. The northern kingdom fell. It was taken away into captivity, and Judah was even more isolated just there on her own. So Hezekiah had a very difficult job indeed, and we won't go into the history of that, but just to say that Manasseh, the final king who came along after Hezekiah, was somebody who didn't like Isaiah much, and it's possible that Isaiah died as a result of Manasseh deciding he was going to get rid of him. There's a legend, which nobody knows whether it's true or not, that Isaiah died by being sawn in half, which is not a good way to go. So, there are the two prophets at this point, Micah and Hosea, as I mentioned, and the whole of Isaiah's prophecies fall into that tricky period in there. So, there's a lot going on in the life of Isaiah, and the book itself, the 66 chapters of it, we're not going to get through all of this, we're just going to look at the first 12 chapters in this series, I think talks about three different things. And it gradually broadens out its focus. The first section, which goes from chapter 1 to chapter 39, is really about God at work in the world. The second section is about God in universal control. And this is probably written when Judah itself has been taken off into captivity, when they're in the land of Babylon. And people are saying, has God got any future for the Jews? Here we are in the midst of a great world empire. Is God in charge not just of the nations around us, but also in charge of the whole world? And Isaiah says, yes, he is. And the final section of the book talks about God and his holiness, and it broadens out even further and talks a lot more about the nature of God. So you've got those three different sections to the book, gradually spreading out in focus, and we're going to be doing this series from within the first one, God at work in the world. And God is talked about, or God's agent in the world is talked about in different ways. You see God the King in the first section, and that's very much what we've been reading about in chapter 2, isn't it? The fearful presence of the Lord, the splendor of his majesty. Then in the second section, you have four servant songs, which talk about the servant of the Lord, who's going to be the agent of God's purposes. And those are pretty obviously, from our perspective, songs that talk about Jesus and how Jesus is going to be the heart of everything that God is doing. And then the word that's used again and again in the third section is the Redeemer. God is going to buy his people back, which is what redeeming means. It's what it's all about. And so those different sections give us a clear view of what God's all about. I'm going to skip this slide completely because it's just too complicated. Let's take on a hot potato question before we get on to chapter 2, which is, how many Isaiahs were there? See, traditionally, people have believed that the whole book was written by one Isaiah. And over the last 100 and 150 years, more and more scholars have been saying, no, it's possible that there were up to three different Isaiahs, one for each section of the book. And the other two who wrote were following in the tradition of the first one, but not really pretending to be the same man. Now, you'll find amongst evangelical scholars, there is a fair amount of difference on this subject. For example, John Goldingay, who was a very close friend of Peter Cousins, whom many of us remember, a good man, a tremendous evangelical Bible scholar, somebody whose faith cannot be doubted, who's been quoted from this platform many, many times, he believes that there were three Isaiahs. On the other hand, Alec Mateer, who has also stood here and preached on several occasions in the past, believes very strongly there was one Isaiah. There are lots of different reasons for saying that there were three. There are lots of different reasons reasons for saying that they're one. I'm not going to go into them now because the clock is racing ahead. So if you want to some more reasons for this one, then for either of those views, see me afterwards. What I will say is the ESV Study Bible that Derek recommended last week makes a very strong case for one Isaiah. I don't know. I don't think it matters all that much, provided you get hold of the message of the book. What I loved on this subject, the ultimate quotation about it, was something Alec Mateer says on one of his tapes. And Mateer has written perhaps the best modern conservative commentary on Isaiah. And Mateer said in this particular talk, if you get to heaven and you find me in a corner arguing fiercely with three men, you'll know I was wrong about Isaiah. So let's leave it at that. Okay, so three sections. We won't even talk about that one either. Let's just get on to chapter 2 and talk about it, shall we? Because that's the important thing. What do you find in chapter 2? Well, there are really two sections. The first section is verses 1 to 5, and it talks about the mountain of the Lord. The mountain of the Lord will be raised above all other hills. It will be the highest in the world. Well, Mount Zion is the highest point in Jerusalem, but it's not a particularly high place. And so Isaiah's got a bizarre kind of vision here of Mount Zion gradually growing and growing and growing until it's higher than Kilimanjaro, higher than Everest, higher than everything else. What's he saying? Well, he's using that picture to say that God's temple, the presence of God, which is centered on Mount Zion, will become the most important thing in the world. God himself, who doesn't occupy a great place in the thinking of many people in the world's population at this moment, will become the center of everything in our world. The mountain of the Lord will rise above all the other hills. And then, having given us those five verses of hope, he goes into talking about the day of the Lord, a coming day when God is going to move in judgment against his people. And what he's saying is the mountain of the Lord can't rise to the height I'm talking about unless the day of the Lord comes first. The day of the Lord was a phrase that had been used by an earlier prophet. There hadn't been many prophets whose work is recorded in Scripture up to this point. The only earlier one really was Amos. And Amos was a very significant person in the history of the nation of Israel because he was the one who coined this phrase, the day of the Lord. He was the man who came along and said, you know what? Things are not going to go the way they are forever. It's not going to be a case of civilization going round and round, century after century, just the same thing, year after year after year. One of these days, God is going to bring history to a final, decisive, shuddering point. And he called that point the day of the Lord. And the prophets that come after Amos pick up that theme and say, yes, it's coming. And it's not going to be fun either. Because when God puts right everything that's wrong in this world, you'd better watch. And so, as Isaiah talks about the mountain of the Lord, he talks in the first couple of verses, the first three verses, about the way in which God is going to bring the nations together. And then he says in verse 4, this is going to be in peace. He'll judge between the nations. He'll settle disputes for many peoples. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And the things that Brian was describing this morning, the weapons of mass destruction will not be used anymore. No wars will break out. And they won't even train for war anymore. You won't see peacetime armies. You won't see people practicing martial skills. There will be no point because God will have brought peace to his world. But the day of the Lord is a different matter. Now, this whole second section, you might not notice, but it's arranged as a chiasm. That means a kind of mirror image poem where you get the same ideas balancing one another. So you see at the start of it and the finish of it, it talks about trust in men. And so in verse 6, you have abandoned your people, says Isaiah to God, the house of Jacob. They're full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and clasp hands with pagans. And he talks about how untrustworthy people are. Then in verse 22, if you look down to the end, stop trusting in human beings who have but a breath in their nostrils. Why hold them in esteem? You move into the poem a little bit and you find there's a bit about idols. Their land is full of silver and gold. Their land is full of idols, verse 8. And at the end of it, there's a bit about idols as well, being thrown away in verse 20. They'll throw away to the moles and bats their idols of silver and idols of gold. You move in a little bit further and you find a verse about hiding in the rocks in verse 10. Go into the rocks, hide in the ground. And in verse 19, you notice people will flee to caves in the rocks and to holes in the ground. It sounds repetitive, doesn't it? But what Isaiah is doing is balancing it so carefully that you start to see there's a hidden pattern behind it. And what he's saying through this is something that God is definitely going to do. It's patterned, it's organized, it's purposive. I'm not just coming out with random ideas. Holes in the ground, yep, then this. It's very, very carefully structured, and God has a plan behind everything that's going to happen. Then you've got a section about God's day against pride in both halves, and finally, right in the middle of the whole thing, high mountains in the first half and lofty towers in the second half. And often the centre of a chiasm is the important point. That's what he's trying to get to. And it's obvious, isn't it, that having spoken about the mountain of the Lord and how that's going to rise high above every other mountain, he's now contrasting that with the high structures that we build for ourselves, high mountains and lofty towers that symbolise human arrogance and turning away from God. So Isaiah is saying God is going to do something great in the world, but he'll do it through a remnant of his people, not through all of them. There is going to be a judgment. There's going to be a refining. Some people are going to miss out, and we need to be aware of where we stand. So let's have a look then at what he's saying. Let's look at that first section to begin with. What is he saying through this vision of God's mountain rising higher than all of the others? He's saying God's people need to see the future. You need to realize where the world is going. Now, the big question about verses 1 to 5, I guess, is when is all of this stuff going to happen? And different people have different views about it. Some people say, well, this is a picture of the end of time when Jesus has come back and everything has been sorted out. There's a new heaven and a new earth. Other people say, no, this is one particular thing that will happen on the prophetic calendar before the end, when Jesus comes back to the earth and rules over the world for 1,000 years with Jerusalem as his capital. Other people say, no, this is what's happening now. It's not fulfilled yet, and we won't see the fulfillment of it until the end of the age. But already the gospel is spreading throughout the world. Already it's bringing peace and freedom to people who never knew about it before. And we're starting to see things happen. Now, I don't really mind which of those interpretations you adopt. The important thing is Isaiah insists it's coming. We're going to see it. And we need to realize that this is God's vision for his planet. He doesn't want war. He doesn't want scarcity. He doesn't want people to be constantly fearful of one another, at odds with one another, building up defenses against one another. He wants humanity to share the same love and trust and openness of relationship that's always existed in the Trinity since before time itself existed. That's what God's vision for us has always been, and that is what one day he will bring about. And so God's people need to see the future. This is where we're going. So right now, we need to be doing what Brian was talking about, getting rid of our own weapons of mass destruction, living as people of peace, working to end oppression and injustice, bringing peace wherever we can in the world, not because we arrogantly think we can do it by ourselves, but because that's what we're about as people of the future. We need to see the future and realize this is what our lives are about. It's not about getting married, having kids, building an income to leave to them, and then dying. It's bigger than that. We're part of God's plan to revolutionize his whole creation, and everything we do has to be seen in the light of that. But God's people need to do more than see the future. God's people have to want the future too. How much do you want this, says Isaiah? Are you part of the mindset of the second part of the chapter, where people are just bound by earthly things? Or how much is your heart and your mind engaged in seeing God's kingdom come? Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Right at the heart of the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, isn't it? It's what we should be praying in those words or in other words every single day. Lord, what I want is your kingdom. What I want to see is your future. And Isaiah is painting it in these arresting terms for his people, because he's saying, look, if you are the people of God, it's not enough to live a limited, time-bound life. You've got to see yourself as part of something absolutely massive, or you've missed the whole point for which God called you to himself. And there's more than that. It's not just seeing the future and wanting the future. A third thing he's saying is you've got to live the future too. And so he ends that little vision of the future by wheeling round to the people of Israel now and saying, come, house of Jacob, verse 5. Come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. That word come comes up twice in that section, doesn't it? The first come is a future one, when people from all of the nations who've never had anything to do with God suddenly say, come, let's go to Mount Zion. Let's go to the presence of God. That's a future day. That's not now. But the second come is for God's people right away. Come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Be that kind of people now. Show the world a glimpse of what God wants to do with this planet. Live such a revolutionary, crazy, radical lifestyle here and now that people see in you something they can't explain, but something which points to a future glory that otherwise they'd never believe in. Then he moves on. Oh, and just before we get there, this is something that has really touched me big time over the last couple of weeks. This man has got to be a great Australian hero. He's somebody who wrote a blog called How the Light Gets In. His name is Christian Anderson, and he's a larger-than-life character. He was a good enough athlete to get into Australia's Olympic squad, but he turned down the opportunity. I'll tell you why in a moment. He's somebody who came to the notice all over the world when he made a video for his wife's birthday. Managed to persuade the New Zealand Prime Minister to introduce it, because she comes from New Zealand, his wife, and to get one of Australia's best-known actors to go into the video and say, he loves you, Rachel, he really loves you, he loves you, Rachel, Rachel, he loves you. And it's an amazing video, and not surprisingly, it went viral on YouTube. It's had about 500,000 viewings. As a result, Oprah Winfrey had him and her on her show, and realised that he had cancer. He was going to die. And that's what the blog is all about. And actually, on January the 2nd this year, Christian Anderson reached the end of the road. He died. Not before a lot of other amazing things had happened to him, which you can read in his blog. But the great thing is Christian Anderson is a Christian. He lived a fantastic life here on earth, which has now gone on to heaven. And although he's left behind a sorrowing wife, and she's written on the blog just this week, I miss him every day, he's left behind a fantastic, triumphant testimony too. And How the Light Gets In is a blog about how the light gets into this shattered, fragmented, sinful world through the things that happen to us, even through getting cancer. His last entry in the blog, just before he died, reads like this. I'm not sure how much longer I have left, but it appears that the physical and medical signs are all pointing to my end. And what a great time to go right at Christmas time. Just wonderful. The time my Saviour was brought into the world is the very same time he decides to call me home. The irony is astounding. While I struggle to find any logical rhyme or reason in all of this, my commitment to following him has not changed. People look at me like I'm crazy. How can I trust God to deliver me from this madness when this madness means losing my wife and two beautiful children? And the answer is, I simply don't know. It's the light that permeates the brokenness. It's the light that the three wise men followed that night when Christ was born. It's the light that just came to be when God said, let there be light on the first day of creation. It's unexplainable. And as I said before, even though it makes no sense, I will follow it until my very end. It's the light that shines for every man and woman, and thankfully it shines for me, lest I be lost in the darkness that surrounds me without it. Thank you for journeying with me thus far. I pray you find the same peace I have. There's a man who knew how to grasp the purposes of God and live them out in the most puzzling and heartbreaking of circumstances. I recommend that blog to you, howthelightgetsin.net. Have a look. There are months and months of fantastic entries, little stories you'd never believe. But anyhow, let's get back to Isaiah just for a couple of minutes as we finish. How about the rest of the chapter then? Well, Isaiah springs round after giving this vision and says, what's the problem with the people of God? And he talks about four things. First of all, he says they're full of superstitions. They're a superstitious people. What's a superstition? Why do people follow superstitions? Why do football players put on one boot rather than the other, or if they don't remember to do that, have a very bad game? Why is it that fishermen in the village where I grew up, if they were going down to the harbour to go out in their boats and they saw a pig, or if they saw the Church of Scotland minister, would turn round and go back home and not go to sea that day? Why do we have superstitions? Well, the answer is, really, superstitions are a way of controlling the unknown, of putting me in charge. If I do this, I'll be fine. I carry my St. Christopher around with me, then I can't have a travel accident. I touch wood and I'm made safe from whatever I've just said. You know, those kinds of things are primitive ways of just trying to put me in charge. And that was what was happening. And it was happening to the people because of the other nations round about. And Isaiah says they practice divination like the Philistines. They're full of superstitions from the east. They clasp hands with pagans. God's people have started falling into the same mindset as everybody else, thinking, if I don't stay in control, my life is going to go haywire. But it wasn't just full of superstitions. They were full of silver and gold as well. They were doing quite well. And they become materialistic. The country was full of good things, and they were living largely for their own bank accounts, for their own incomes, for their own material satisfaction. And that's what happens when you start taking charge of your own life for yourself, isn't it? It's the things around you that are important. What you see is what you get. And so the more you have for yourself, the happier you are. You need safety, though, as well. And so the land was full of horses. What's this talking about? Horses and chariots? Well, it's talking about buying your own security, making yourself safe through making yourself strong and wealthy and powerful. On paper, on the balance sheet, Israel, or Judah rather, wasn't doing badly in Isaiah's day. But it was a long way from where it ought to be as far as God was concerned. The end result is that land is full of idols too. And that's the fourth part of Isaiah's analysis, verse 8. Their land is full of idols and they bow down to the work of their hands. Because when you live life in that way, centered on what you can do, on what you can achieve, you start worshipping it. It becomes your be-all and end-all. And the God who created everything drops right out of the picture. And Isaiah says you can't live that way because God's judgment is coming. We've left no time to talk about God's judgment, but he makes 4 points about it, I think. First of all, it includes everybody. And Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the Prince of Preachers, had some things to say about this. Nothing can be more absurd than for a man to take his hoe and weed everybody else's garden and leave all the thorns and thistles to flourish on his own plot. We easily see the problems with other people, but we excuse them in ourselves very often, don't we? There's so much dirty linen in our own house, says Spurgeon, needing to be washed, that none of us need to take in our neighbour's washing. And yet it's easy to do that, to look at other people and go, oh, look at his dirty washing, at least I'm not like him. God says, my judgment includes everybody. And God's judgment plays no favourites. Whether you're the highest or the lowest in the country, Isaiah says, you're part of this. Nobody gets out of it. And he goes through all the kind of people that can be in the country, all the kinds of structures that can be set up, and says, not one escapes. God doesn't play favourites. Don't excuse yourself. Don't say, I'm a friend of God's and therefore he won't judge me. Judge yourself first. God's judgment is dreadful. And God's judgment, finally, he says, can't be escaped. There is no way out of it. And although the purpose of God's judgment with his people is to refine them and to make them strong and bring them back to what they ought to be, it still, says Isaiah, is going to be searching and real. And so he says, judge yourself now. Walk in the light of the Lord now. Get yourself sorted out now. Don't make excuses for yourself. Don't justify what you know to be sin. Don't settle for second-hand standards. Get a vision of God's future, of God's plan, of what you're involved in, and then live that out. We're going to sing our final song now, and Paul and the band are going to come back up. And it's a song about the fact that from God's judgment, we have an escape, because God is a God of mercy too. And before the throne of God above, we have a strong, a perfect plea, a great high priest whose name is love, whoever lives and pleads for us. So we're going to sing about that. But let's not lose the impact of what God is saying. Isaiah is saying, God's future will happen, but God's judgment comes first. There's a terrifying verse in 1 Peter that says, it's time for judgment to begin at the house of God. And we need, like those Israelites years ago, to look at ourselves and say, what kind of life am I living? Who am I living it for? Which do I see as the highest thing towering above all the other mountains? God's future, Mount Zion, or the structures I've built? That's the challenge of us.